Thank you, and I appreciate that introduction and the opportunity to come visit with you. Linda and I live in North Roger Mills County, and the world is just a little greener here than it is 2 hours to the west and the south of you. So I'm envious. But then they talk about the potential for rain, and I want the wheat tour to go on, and I want it to be a wonderful success. But you have to remember, when you come from Roger Mills County, as my father used to say, any time it rains, you're supposed to run outside and just scream with delight and joy, because it never rains enough to the west of you. That said, right now back east, we are in the process of putting the next five-year farm bill together. And that's what I want to visit with you about for a moment, are the challenges that we face back there, those of us who represent you, and the challenges that you're going to face as we work our way through this process. If you could bear with me for just a moment, think about the nature of the environment we're working in back east. Now, I'm going to use 3rd District of Oklahoma definitions, and whatever your political or philosophical perspective might be, you can take it with a grain of salt if you choose to. But for the last 2, now going on 3 years, we had the environment back east where you've got a very conservative House, by the definitions of the 3rd District. You've got a very liberal president, by the definitions of the 3rd District. You've got a United States Senate where, under their rules, you have to have 60 of the 100 folks to agree on something to vote, to shut off the unlimited debates, can vote, then to get to vote. So it's an interesting place. So nobody's in control. So that's the environment. And the voters of this great country, both in 2010 and 2012, chose to put these pieces in play. So that's where I'm working. Add on top of that, the nature of the turnover of the place. Now you're going to say, Frank, it's a spot full of stogies and fogies and old coots. Well, the fact of the matter is we've had a big turnover. And you say, why does it matter to us? Well, the knowledge, institutional knowledge, and understanding of the legislation makes a big difference. Literally, when we bring the farm bill to the floor of the United States House next month in June, and I've been promised that by leadership, half the members of the 435-person House of Representatives will have never debated, never seen, never voted on a farm bill before, and the last one was in 2008. So think about that. Half the membership of the whole House has turned over since the last farm bill. And quite literally, 60% of the Ag Committee was not around for the last farm bill in 2008. So you've got a unique political environment. You've got a membership that doesn't have any memory of the debates about why this is important. And on top of that, you have a national debt that's $16 trillion. Maybe we'll avoid the 5th annual deficit of $1 trillion this time by just a little bit. So there's not any money, there's not any experience, and there's not any consensus. So think about that environment when we begin to put the farm bill together. Now that said, where are we? Next Tuesday, the Senate will mark up their version of a bill in committee. The day after, on Wednesday, in the House Agriculture Committee, we'll mark up our version of the bill. Now the bill, like all bills coming out of the House, will spend less money. It'll spend a lot less money than the previous farm bill, to the tune of about $38 billion less money. But remember, that's $16 trillion national debt, those trillion-dollar annual deficits. Everybody's got to cinch their belt, is the perspective of the House. But what's the bill going to look like, you're asking, of course. Well, of that $38 billion in savings, about $20 billion of it's going to come out of the nutrition side of the farm bill. Because remember, even though the TV people back east and the radio people and the New York Times and the Los Angeles newspapers all call the farm bill the cotton program or the wheat program or the corn program, remember about 80% of the spending in recent years have gone to the social nutrition programs, the feeding programs, school lunch, food stamps, WIC, women, infants, and children. And the other 20%, the things that you and I would say actually raise food, the commodity title, rural development, agricultural research, conservation, farm credit, that's the other 20%. In the bill we'll take up next week in the committee, we're going to save $20 billion out of the nutrition programs. Do things like end something called categorical eligibility. No longer will you be able to go in and automatically get food stamps if you've gotten some other federal welfare benefit. We're going to make everybody, everybody, prove what their assets are and their income is. And if you need help, if you meet the requirements, we're going to help you. But you're going to have to prove it. We're going to end the federal government's advertising of the food stamp program. We're going to require that you demonstrate you are actually an American when you apply for food stamps. Some really amazing little simple things we're going to force into the system. And our friends back east have something they call LIHEAP. This is the most amazing thing to me. They help pay for people's home heating costs in the Northeast. And a number of states have used a loophole in the 1996 Welfare Reform Act to say that if they send you a $1 check to buy home heating oil, that's probably somewhere between a cup and a pint, then you automatically get a full month's worth of food stamps. We're going to raise that requirement to $20, and that's going to save $8 billion. So big savings for the first time in 20 years in the feeding programs. And this is not going to be without controversy. On the commodity side, what are we doing? Direct payments go away. I have made the argument back east till I'm blue in the face that the old direct payment program was the most WTO, World Trade Organization compliant, the most understandable, the most logical way to create a safety net. But alas, in the world that I work, logic and common sense don't always flow very much. So dealing with what I've got to deal with, they go away. We'll plow part of the money that's saved there back into the crop insurance program. The Senate wants to do something called shallow loss crop revenue. Basically, it'll work really well if you're a corn farmer in the Midwest. But the House insists, and it'll be in our bill, the House insists that there be options for all of us, not just somebody in the I states. And that's why we'll have what I refer to as a price protection option that'll work, I think, for the rest of the country and all the rest of the commodity groups. But in the House draft of the bill, when you sign up for the five-year farm bill, as it's now crafted, you will pick which way you go. You'll have a choice. You'll have the ability to decide what you want to do. Not one size fits all. Conservation. We bring down the number of CRP acres to 24 million. That's inevitable. You're deciding, those of you who have CRP across the country, as those voluntary contracts expire, to bring it back into production. That's just what the renewable fuel standard has done to the price of corn and affected commodity grain prices. We cap CSP. We consolidate conservation programs. We do a number of things. But the bottom line is this. Unlike any effort that I've seen in my tenure in Congress, we're actually going to make sure that if we achieve savings, everybody's participating. Not just the folks that raise food. Everybody's going to participate in these savings. We have a bill that still represents itself as a safety net on both sides. We'll do okay in the House Agriculture Committee. A year ago, when we did this first effort, we had 100 amendments. We started at 10 o'clock one morning, and we went all day and all night, and we finished at 1 o'clock the next morning. Now, I think we have vetted a lot of stuff. I would hope we only have 50 or 60 amendments next Wednesday. I would hope we're only in committee for 9 or 10 hours instead of 15. But we'll work our way through the process. And then we'll go to the floor. Now, you got to understand, the floor is a tough battle. Because, how do I describe this? Think for a moment about the Agriculture Committee. That's our committee. That's Rural America's committee. That's the producers. That's the processors. That's our committee. But even in the House Agriculture Committee, about 40% of the committee is there because of the social nutrition programs. About 40% of the committee is there because, like myself, they're either directly involved in ag or they have districts that are so focused on ag, they know what they're doing. Now, the other 20% of the committee is probably there because somebody on their steering committee didn't like them and they put them on the ag committee. But that could be any committee. But that's our committee. We're 40%, those of us who know and really care, of our committee. So if that's our committee, think about when we go to the floor of the United States House. Think about all the berserk amendments we're going to have to deal with. They will go after us over crop insurance. They want to turn down the money we invest in making crop insurance viable. There's always a tax on the conservation monies, the working lands programs monies. There will be a tax on having choice for production agriculture. There will be amendments on everything from what size a chicken cage should be to how much room you should give a cow. All that sort of goofy stuff. Sorry, all of those misguided amendments is what I meant to say. But we'll fight all that back, and we'll struggle our way through it, and we'll sit down to the United States Senate and put the final document together. Can we have it done in time for you to know before you put the wheat back in the ground this fall? How many times has that happened in the lifetime of anybody standing here? It's pretty close to zero. But I do believe we can be far enough along in the process you're going to know what it will look like, and you'll have some degree of certainty when you visit with your spouse and your banker and your landlord, whatever the case may be, to make those decisions as we move forward. I try to explain to the folks back east that the 3rd District of Oklahoma, being the nice, compact 32-county congressional district that it is, represents some of the best farmland and some of the most challenging farmland out there. And I try to remind the folks I serve with that if you look in the last century, the drought of the 50s stands out. Scarred my parents for life, attitude-wise. The drought of the 30s and its effect on my grandparents. All people that I farmed with when I started. But it's not just the drought, because I guess if you want to do something about the weather, you should talk to the Senate. I really can't help you with that. But in the 30s and in the 1980s, and some of you remember the collapse in land prices in the 1980s, those were results of bad federal policy. Decisions in the 20s and 30s that made the Depression the horrible experience it was. Decisions made in the 70s and 80s that made the 80s as bad as it was. I may not be able to do anything about weather, but you have my commitment. On my watch, we're not going to pass a farm bill that sets up for the next 1930s or the next 1980s. That's not going to happen. And we'll push and we'll pull and we'll struggle and we'll fight. We'll do our part in saving in the overall federal budget, but we're still going to have a farm bill that represents a functioning safety net. And we're going to take care of those folks who don't have enough to eat. Don't worry about that. But they're just going to have to prove they qualify. I think that's a reasonable thing. Again, thank you for the chance to come and visit. Thank you for being tolerant of my comments. And sometime before this year's over with, together we'll get it all done and we'll get a bill on the books and we'll have it signed in for the next 5 years. And then we'll go back to chasing the EPA and the IRS and all of the other things out there that torment you on a day-to-day basis. But we've got to get this farm bill back on the books for the next 5 years. One last thought, and I say this to my good friends from Oklahoma State and the research community. When I worked my way from the bottom end all the way up to be chairman of the committee, I had these grand visions about the wonderful things that we were all going to do together, the investments that we were going to make. Because after all, long before there was ever a comprehensive farm bill, the federal government invested in research. One of Mr. Lincoln's greatest signatures was the Morrow Act, creating the land-grant college system. Creation of the Ag Research Stations, the ARS within USDA, another example. We have always made tremendous investments in research. In normal times, had I had the privilege of being chairman, in normal budget times, I had grand goals. But I find myself with the privilege of being chairman when not only do I not have any new money, I don't have any old money. I don't have as much money. So together we've got to work our way through all these things and try and preserve the good work that's been done. Because the budgets will get better. The economy will get better in spite of Congress and the President. It will get better. And from that point, we'll have to move aggressively forward. Again, thank you for the chance to be here and for being the kind of folks you are.
If there's a couple short questions, I'm sure Congressman Lucas would take a stab at them best he can.
I do pay my taxes on time, and I am married to the same woman, so we'll get that over with right quick. I know what people think of members of Congress. Yes, sir. Well, the question is, why do they always talk about 10 years? In the budget process they use to count everything, to score everything, they do a 10-year number. So it makes it kind of wild when you write a farm bill because you're using 10-year numbers for a 5-year farm bill. I would tell you that a big part of funding the farm bill this time is the overall budget mess, and that's the national economy. There have been a number of mistakes made in the last 5 years, letting the deficit explode and trying to borrow enough money to spend our way out of the recession was a bad mistake. So instead of taking what I believe should have been a relatively short recession, we've made it into this 5-year-plus experience. But in spite of that, the American economy is going to overcome it. But we use 10-year numbers. That's just the way the 1974 Budget Act works. Oh, things that I will note to you. The 1974 Budget Act says the president has to submit a budget to Congress, then each chamber has to write a budget, then we work out our differences, and then we do the appropriation bills. In all fairness to the United States Senate, this is the first time in 4 years, and this is not Jim or Tom's fault, they actually did their budget. Unfortunately, the president got his budget to us 2 months late, which meant a month after we'd finished all our work. Shame on him. But then sometimes not everybody wants to take responsibility and make decisions either. How safe is the ethanol mandate? Do you want me to answer that as a wheat guy or as a cattle guy? The only reason I make that point is the renewable fuel standard is making writing farm bill policy so complicated. I mean, every policy lecture I set through at Oklahoma State, every discussion at home in the coffee shop, every discussion I ever had with my father, renewable fuel just changed all the dynamics. Now think for a moment about why it makes it so complicated. You got one crop in the country that distills with a really high alcohol yield. It's a shame the Lord didn't make the wheat berry just a little different. But this is the way it is. And we don't distill like that. So the ethanol programs have essentially embraced almost universally corn. That means last year about 45% of the corn crop under this federal mandate went through the ethanol cookers to make ethanol. Now some of my friends in the Midwest say, but Frank, that's not a federal mandate, that's not an interference. When you pass a law that says the refiners have to buy so many billion gallons of ethanol every year to blend with the gasoline, don't have a choice, have to do it, then they turn and buy the highest yield, most affordable price-wise, ethanol product, and that's produced by corn. So 40-45% of the corn crop has gone to the ethanol cookers. That affects cow feed availability and price, and poultry, and pork, and every other animal's feed source. So it's in this 2-year drought, have dramatically affected the price of my 20% cake back home. But it also means they have a market that nobody else has. So how do you craft a farm bill that takes into consideration probably the biggest single commodity volume-wise in the country that has a federal mandate that nobody else has, and it's a federal mandate? How do you craft farm policy to work for every other commodity group that tees off of that when you don't have that same effect? That's why we come up with choice. Shallow loss crop revenue that the Senate and the corn folks want says you take the last 5 years of prices, and in the draft of the bill they filed yesterday, if you have an 12% drop from that 5-year price, triggers a payment. Well, if 45% of your crop's been going through a federal mandate, then you have prices that are different than anybody else's for the last 5 years. And don't forget the drought last year sustained those prices. Oh, by the way, remember, it's not market distorting. So how much corn did we plant last year? Even with almost 30 million acres of CRP, most corn since 1937. What does USDA announce the planting intentions for this year's corn crop? Most corn since 1936. point being, the renewable fuel mandate has affected agriculture across the spectrum. And part of our challenge in the Ag Committee is how to help craft a safety net for everybody else who doesn't have that guaranteed market demand. Now, I'll go one step farther and say, what happens if we have two perfect weather years in the Midwest and they pile the corn in Main Street, Indianapolis, and the pile goes all the way to Main Street, Omaha, Nebraska? Now, I'm practical enough to know, and you are too, even though the various feed grains are not exactly alike, nutrition-wise, utilization-wise, they are substitutable in the right circumstances. Even with that huge federal mandate, the market signals and the biggest crop since 36, if you drive corn prices through the floorboards, what's it going to do to wheat and barley and everything else? Yes. And that's why we need a choice besides crop revenue, which assumes the good times never stop, because we haven't had the good times. And we got to have something down here. Avoid a 1982, a 1932. So that's why choice is so important. We're going to get there, and we're going to get the choice. Oh, by the way, renewable fuel is on the books in its present form until 23. You let me write a farm bill, it runs till 2023, and life will be good for all of us. But I'd never had that choice. Thank you.